It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll look at a proposed project from the 1960s that would have turned northern Wisconsin's bedrock into a giant radio antenna.
First, Milwaukee is in the midst of a dramatic spike in gun violence. Gun homicides are up 160% so far this year at around 40, compared with 14 for the same period last year.
Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett and Police Chief Ed Flynn are at odds with Republican lawmakers over whether state gun laws are playing a role in the spate of violence. This weekend, Chief Flynn told WISN that Wisconsin has the worst gun laws that he's ever worked under and that he wants them tightened up.
Here with us now to talk about gun laws in Wisconsin is Jerry Bonavia, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort. Jerry, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So, as we said, Mayor Barrett, Chief Flynn, blaming the spike in violence in part, not in total, but in part on Wisconsin gun laws, things like concealed carry, not enough crackdown on criminals carrying guns. Do you think that they're pointing in the right direction here?
Well, I think it certainly could be playing a role. And unfortunately, we probably won't know for a matter of months or longer exactly what is causing this spike. We'll need the benefit of 2020 hindsight to fully understand. But what we do know right now is that we could be doing a much better job preventing gun violence. And I think that's one of the things that the chief and mayor have talked about, is that the state of Wisconsin desperately needs stronger, better common sense gun laws.
So what kind of changes are you hoping to see in those laws?
Well, the first thing is requiring background checks on all gun sales. We've seen that work effectively in other cities, other states, and we know it's something that we could be doing right now to make a tremendous difference in the level of gun violence we have here.
A lot of people will say, supporters of gun rights, that, okay, all the background checks you want, if somebody wants to illegally purchase a gun, they'll purchase it illegally. All the background checks in the world won't prevent them doing that.
Well, right now we do absolutely nothing to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people. And so if we at least create an obstacle for people who would be prohibited from purchasing firearms, it will help. We've seen it help in other places. We know it works.
Yeah. How do you compare what's going on in Milwaukee with what you've seen in other cities and gun laws in those cities and states?
So if we look at places that have those stronger gun laws in place, New York, for example, and Hawaii and Connecticut, Massachusetts, what we see is that there is definitely a correlation between the states with the strongest gun laws and lower firearm death rates. Another interesting point is looking at states that have changed their gun laws, some for the better, some for the worse. We can look to Missouri, for example, that had at one time required background checks on all gun sales. They removed that law, and what they saw was a spike in firearm homicides of about 23%.
Talking to Jerry Bonavia, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort, about Wisconsin's gun laws and recent increase in gun violence in Milwaukee. Looking at this from the perspective of a gun owner outside of Milwaukee, elsewhere in the state, they might say, hey, yes, there's this violence problem, but this is something that, this is the urban condition of Milwaukee. This is the economic background. This is a high crime area. Don't punish my ability, don't restrict my ability to buy guns elsewhere in the state based on what's going on there.
Well, something like requiring background checks doesn't affect any law-abiding gun owners. I come from a gun-owning family, and they certainly are supportive of these types of measures. Unlike the NRA leadership, the NRA membership is actually quite supportive of these common-sense measures. And interestingly, gun violence doesn't just affect Milwaukee. We hear about it because the numbers are higher. But the entire state is afflicted with, instances of gun violence, and we need to do a better job of keeping guns out of the hands of dangerous people. Right now, we attempt under our federal laws to kind of throw a net out there, and in some ways we're throwing it we're casting it too widely and in other ways too narrowly. And we have good, solid research that tells us how we can do a better job. We need to be doing that.
Outside of background checks, what do you think needs to be changed for people with criminal records who are caught illegally owning a gun and to keep them from having a gun if they shouldn't?
Well, it turns out that the best predictor of future violence is past violence. And whether it is the person has been convicted of a violent misdemeanor or a felony, it turns out that the level of dangerousness when it comes to owning guns is actually quite similar. So one of the things that we could do is at least temporarily prohibit people who have been convicted of violent misdemeanors or people who have a long history of criminal behavior, even if it didn't rise to the level of a felony. It turns out that's a really good predictor for future gun violence as well. So habitual criminals, violent criminals, those people should be prohibited from purchasing or possessing firearms.
Given the makeup of the state legislature, the response of some Republican leaders to what Mayor Barrett and Chief Flynn have had to say, they said, hey, you're casting blame where it doesn't belong. Look to what you're doing in your own city. Do you see any likelihood that these changes would happen under the current legislature?
Well, I think they should. You know, certainly it's difficult to watch these tragedies unfolding and not be moved to take some actions. I think that, you know, the types of actions that are allowed in cities, given that we're in a state that prevents municipalities from passing stronger gun laws than state law, you know, the hands of local officials are kind of tied when it comes to gun violence prevention. And this notion that we can, you know, effectively prevent gun violence by addressing other areas, things like poverty or lack of jobs, is just wrong. I mean, if you look to the cities and states that have the lowest firearm death rates, they also have poverty. They also have problems with unemployment or schools not performing as well as they should. And yet they've managed to successfully tease out and address gun violence.
Let's go to a caller. We've got Joe on the line in Milwaukee. Joe, hi.
Oh, hi. What I just wanted to say is, okay, from Milwaukee, I know all of these inner city people that have the guns, that are felons, that shouldn't have them, whatever, whatever. But they really only have the guns to protect themselves from the other people with the guns. So if, you know, your harder consequences to people that'll, you know, who are not supposed to have a gun really isn't going to do much because they need the gun to save their own life, and they'll take the consequence to rather die. So that's pretty much what it is. Other things, I do agree with your caller. I mean, your person, but otherwise.
Joe, thanks for the call. So the idea that a lot of people in Milwaukee, even if technically they're not supposed to have guns, have either a real or perceived need to protect themselves with a firearm, do they have a right to do that, even if they have that misdemeanor or felony background that you had mentioned earlier?
So, I mean, that's a pretty complicated question. But I think that, you know, one thing that we should be doing is, instead of assuming that gun violence will bring us the protection we desire, is really look at the factors that go into making a good decision. So each family, this is going to be a different equation, but there are definitely risk factors associated with gun ownership. And understanding those risk factors, if, for example, someone in your family has a history of depression or has a history of violence, as I was talking about earlier, then the equation changes. And I think understanding that there are indeed risks with gun ownership as well as potential benefits, I think we would probably be a lot better off.
Short of changes to state and federal law, do you see local leaders in a city like Milwaukee, a mayor, a police chief, having things they can do to prevent gun violence?
I do, and I think that, you know, here in Milwaukee, Mayor Barrett and Chief Flynn have been, you know, searching for and trying to implement some of those ideas. But again, if we want to address gun violence, we need to address gun violence and not try to get at it by coming at it from all of these other angles. There are things that we can do that truly will be effective. We just need the political will in this state to do them.
Jerry, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
There's Jerry Bonavia, executive director of the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort, talking about the recent increase in gun violence in Milwaukee.
Did you know that under a U.S. Navy-led plan in the 1970s, the state was almost turned into the world's largest radio antenna? Well, the Navy wanted to channel the state's Bedrock Foundation and use a whole slew of cables to send signals around the world, all from northern Wisconsin.
If it sounds like a wild plan, maybe it was. Ultimately, the cost and the environmental damage the project would have required were enough to kill off the proposal, but was the inspiration for a smaller project in Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Joining us now with a look at this story is Joseph Stromberg. He's a science writer at Vox. Joseph, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
So you recently dug into this history, this project called Project Sanguine, which would have radically changed the way Wisconsin looked in part of northern Wisconsin. Where did this idea come from in the first place?
So this idea came from a physicist named Nicholas Christofilis, and essentially he was trying to solve the problem of how to communicate with deep sea submarines. So this is still a huge problem. Radio waves get scattered by ocean water, and the Navy and other countries' navies have to use all sorts of different workarounds to get signals to submarines. And so he proposed generating extremely long frequency radio waves to communicate with subs instead. The only problem is to do this, you'd need a really, really huge antenna that would probably be far more expensive than any Navy would be interested in investing in. And so he suggested using the bedrock to actually generate radio waves instead of building an enormous antenna.
Well, to back up to why it's so difficult for subs to receive this communication, why is that? What happens in the water that makes it hard?
So extremely long frequency waves, they essentially just get scattered as they penetrate down through the water, especially because it's salt water, which conducts electricity better. So usually to get signals from the surface, submarines either have to come to the surface themselves. Some of them trail a little buoy that has an antenna on it. And back in the days of the Cold War, it was a huge problem that subs had to either come to the surface or move more slowly. The Navy was somewhat paranoid about them being detected by the Soviet Navy. And so they really wanted a way to be able to just send signals directly to the bottom of the ocean floor, wherever the subs are around the world. And normal radio waves that we use to communicate simply can't do that.
And how would this project have worked? You said it would have used the bedrock to create these radio waves. How?
Yeah, so essentially, if you could imagine a really long cable stretching miles and miles, and at either end you stick it into the ground. And when you turn it on, the electric current that you send through the cable wants to complete a circuit. It wants to get back from one end to the other. And if you stick both ends into the ground, that electric current is actually going to flow through the bedrock. Now, with low levels of current, it wouldn't electrify anyone or be dangerous. But what it would do is, as that current flows miles and miles through the bedrock and reaches the other end of the cable, the pulse through the bedrock would actually create a magnetic field that would send these extremely long frequency waves through the atmosphere, and eventually they would go all the way around the world and go into the world's oceans. The only difference is, instead of having the cable above the ground, the Navy really wanted to bury it so it would survive a nuclear attack from the Soviets or any other kind of threat.
How close did this project come to being a reality?
Well, the original project, Sanguine, which would have involved burying cables under about 41% of the state, to be fair, that probably didn't come very close to happening. It would have costed billions of dollars and caused a huge amount of environmental disruption. So there were a lot of protests, as you might imagine, from local residents, from Wisconsin politicians, from environmental activists. But what the Navy did was it kept proposing a series of smaller and smaller similar projects. And eventually one of those did get built. It's just called Project ELF, which stands for Extremely Long Frequency, which are the types of waves. And it ended up being a pair of pretty large buried antennas, one in Clam Lake, Wisconsin, and one in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And they operated for 15 years.
Now, back to this original Project Sanguine, which didn't actually come to fruition. You said it would have taken miles and miles of cables. How much cable are we talking about here?
So the original plan, at its most ambitious, was to bury a grid of 6,000 miles of cables. So it would have looked like a big, cross-hatched, some going east-west and some going north-south, so the signals could be broadcast in both directions. but a total of 6,000 miles of cable. So it would have covered just a huge amount of the state, mostly in the northern portion.
We're talking right now with Joseph Stromberg, science writer at Vox, about the history of Project Sanguine, which would have turned northern Wisconsin into a giant radio antenna. And, you know, the question from here in Wisconsin is, why Wisconsin? Why would they want to do this here in the North Woods?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. The primary reason is that to do this, you need to pick a spot that has the right kind of bedrock. You actually want bedrock that doesn't conduct electricity that well, so that the current you send through the bedrock will go really deep and go along a wide range of paths and generate enough of an electric field so that it sends out the extremely long frequency wave. So that's part of it, is the bedrock, specifically the Canadian Shield granite in the area. The other big thing is that you want a relatively unpopulated area. Obviously, there's lots of people up in the North Woods, but, you know, compared to somewhere where there's more dense agriculture, more cities, people that you're going to disrupt with this construction, it's a little bit less. So those are the main two reasons.
Now, I understand it didn't actually, this idea, work that well, effectively, that is, in communicating with submarines. It sounds as though it worked, but it wasn't that efficient.
Yeah. The thing is, these waves, these extremely long frequency waves, they take a very long time to travel, and you can't encode very much information in them. So the way it ended up working when the Navy built the scaled-down version of it is it would send these waves that were essentially, you know, a code for one, two, or three letters. So it's almost like sending out Morse code over the course of 10 or 15 minutes to submarines around the world. You can't actually send that much information. So in effect, what they did was they used this system to beckon submarines to the surface, like almost like an old beeper, saying, okay, you come to the surface now, we need to send you some information through normal radio waves. And this was ultimately one of the criticisms of the project. As activists, especially anti-war activists, wanted to shut it down, they said, look, you created this huge expensive project and all you're doing is using it as a beeper for submarines.
Well, so this project was ultimately killed. It never happened. It was later revived, as you said, on the smaller scale with Project ELF. Where were those antenna up north? Are there, if you go up there and you poke around, can you find remnants of Project ELF?
Yeah, you can. So the one in Wisconsin is at Clam Lake, which is, I believe, part of a national forest. I haven't been up there. But I believe the site is still intact. A lot of the equipment has been dismantled, but the Navy still owns the land. And then the other one is over in the Upper Peninsula in Copper County State Forest. So, again, the cables are buried. Or, sorry, the cables are not buried. They're above the ground. And they're no longer operational. They're not using it to send signals. But a lot of the equipment is still there, intact.
We got a tweet here from Jenners who said, Project ELF ran near my grandparents' land in the Upper Peninsula. We were fascinated with this as kids. It raises the question, is anybody still using this kind of technology today? It sounds like it's pretty much gone away, the dinosaurs in the U.S.
It has, although the Russian Navy, as far as we know, still, they also built a similar type of setup back in the Cold War days. And the information isn't public, but as far as we know, they're still using it to communicate with submarines. So again, it suffers the same kinds of inefficiencies and difficulties as Project ELF, but the Russian Navy's setup, which is all the way up kind of northeast of Norway in Russia, is still operational.
Now, why are the Russians still using it?
That's hard to say. I mean, even the U.S. Navy kept most of the information about it classified and for years claimed that it was a really important communication system until eventually they admitted that it was obsolete and because so many politicians wanted to shut it down. So the Russian Navy doesn't really talk much about their use of it. But as far as we know, they're still using it.
Now, it sounds as though Senator Feingold, introduced some bills to get rid of some of the remnants of Project ELF. What role did he play?
Yeah, he played a big role in actually shutting it down when it was active. It didn't close until 2004. And for years and years, partially with the support of different activists, anti-war and environmental activists, he was one of the leading forces in Congress introducing bills to close it. And in 2004, you could give credit to him as much as anyone else for ending the project.
Any idea what happened with the scientist who was advancing this project back in the 60s?
No, I actually don't. He had a long career in terms of radio frequency physics and other sorts of things. And to be honest, in terms of his career, this is really almost a footnote. Not sure what happened to him after that.
Are remnants of this technology still in use today, maybe in different forms? We talked about the Russians, but does any part of it still live on?
In terms of Project ELF in Wisconsin and Michigan?
ELF and the whole the extremely low-frequency idea.
Not really. Extremely low-frequency raves, I mean, they're almost a curiosity in terms of physics because of the fact that you can use them to send information so far and so deep into the ocean. But, you know, you can. There's so little information you can code into these waves compared to normal radio waves or the frequencies we use for cell phones, things like that. Really, the only possible use would be if you're trying to send information down into the ocean. So, as far as I know, it hasn't really been used for any other sorts of practical communication beyond this.
Joseph, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
We've been talking to Joseph Stromberg, science writer at Vox, who recently looked into the history of Project Sanguine, which would have turned northern Wisconsin into a giant radio antenna. Tax day has come and gone, and we're in the midst of Money Smart Week, a federal effort to get people to be more aware of their personal finances. Since money's on our minds, we gave financial counselor Connie Kilmark a call.
In addition to the dollars and cents, Connie focuses on the relationship we have with our money and our possessions, the emotional impact our finances can have on our lives, and how it all affects our personal relationships. Today, she'll tell us about our financial personalities and how couples and families can share the work and the information surrounding their finances.
Connie Kilmark is a financial counselor and founder of the counseling and consulting firm Kilmark & Associates. Connie, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Connie, you say that it's important to know our financial personality, what our personality is like when it comes to money, and how it affects money together. How does that all work together as a complete package?
Well, when you think about it, financial personality is really a composite. It's made up sort of at the intersection of things like family history, historical period in which you came of age, peer culture and experiences both in your neighborhood and in your school cultures, but continuing even in adult work culture. And then there's a huge portion of it that's composed of what we're calling these days the neurobiology of the way we think about value propositions. You know, what is something worth and how much knowledge do I need before I can make a decision, how quickly I can make a decision. So when you have something as complex as that, and you have something as irrational as love, can you imagine how unlikely it is that we're going to end up in a love relationship with somebody who is the perfect, suitable partner for us financially? It's just so unlikely. So we're going to be bridging differences in our couples' relationships.
Well, let's go into couples for a bit. As we said, it's just been tax time, and some couples maybe sat down together and did their taxes. Many probably didn't. What kind of division of labor do you see working with couples when it comes to money, and how do they divvy up those responsibilities?
Well, I want to say first a shout out for taxes are not a bad thing. Tax is a good thing. It's a subscription fee that we pay together to do certain things together that are just much more affordable when we do them together. So let's just get that out of the way. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't try to minimize the legal burden that you have, but I actually think tax is a great idea. I think the idea of doing your taxes together, first of all, in most couple relationships, there's going to be a significant amount of division of labor. There's going to be, I'll do this if you do that. I'll do the outside chores, you do the inside chores, those kinds of things. So most likely, there's going to be some way in which one partner is more habituated to and expert at thinking about the task of the money, especially after you've been a couple for a while. If, in fact, you're a new couple, it's a great idea to at least gather the information for the preparation together so that at least you know the components that go into the tax picture. But remember, even if both of you do it together, the tax side of things is only a compilation of income and the taxes you owe. It leaves almost completely out significant amount of really important granular detail about what you're spending your money on, and can often evoke a tremendous argument that starts like this. Well, if we're making this much money, where is it going? So be careful if you've been into this for a long time and all of a sudden somebody is entering the discussion because you want both partners to be pulling together, and that's the only side of it that they're seeing, because that can really be quite electric.
Right. What are the downsides when you do have a division of labor like that? One person has more of affinity, say, with the financial aspect, and it makes sense just for the sake of efficiency to have that person do the lion's share of the financial work. But what are the downsides when that happens and when the other person isn't totally plugged into the big financial picture?
Well, you don't have to actually do all the administrative work to be more plugged in than the kind of partnership you're describing, where one person is the spreadsheet brain. And the other person just says, well, he's better or she's better at it. And by the way, this is an equal gender opportunity kind of mindset. Some women and some men are quite analytical and quite spreadsheety. And those are people who are likely to have quite a high tolerance for the sorts of task that tax preparation is. But I think that the idea that the downside is that there's got to be ironclad trust. There's often a sense of, why do I have to do this and why don't you understand? And a tremendous kind of growing ignorance on the part of the person who isn't involved in the task, so that over year after year after year, that person really ends up in a tremendously information deficit position. So I think that it's valuable when making the decisions that flow out of that information sharing that both people at least have some grounding in it, even if they're not both completely doing the granular task.
Well, and Connie, I think we've probably all known someone or had someone in our family in the situation of a spouse passes away or there's a divorce, and now if you're the person who wasn't on the finances, you're starting in a hole and trying to dig yourself out of it, trying to understand what the heck's going on.
Exactly. So there ought to be some familiarity. There ought to be someone lined up if there is a severe division of labor. The person who's been doing it, and I'm talking about couples of goodwill now, not couples who are really trying to snipe at each other and who actually have poor bad will, but in couples of goodwill, if there's been a long-standing pattern where one person has done the task, there ought to be a coach lined up in advance of that person's illness or passing, so that you're thinking as you age, okay, who is going to be able to coach or kind of buddy my not-so-plugged-in partner when the time comes, and some of this will need to be explained, even if we can't get to it as a couple together.
We're talking right now with financial consultant Connie Kilmark about money, relationships, and emotions right now. And Connie, you said there should be some sort of coach. So would that person be a financial planner? I mean, I can see as far as taxes go, just thinking, well, I will have a tax preparer do this instead of myself, even though my partner did it. Is there anything wrong with that, with leaning heavily on somebody else?
Well, as long as the non-financially inclined spouse or partner starts doing that work early enough in the tax season. It's a not great idea ever to be a brand new beginner trying to assemble your tax picture and waiting until April 5th or 7th, because you'll want to use that first season. It's the first season without your partner, if whether it's a divorce or a death or a severe illness, you're going to want to use some time just to get up to speed and figure out, what do I collect and why am I collecting it? And most tax preparers will send you an organizer so that you will have that opportunity. Please don't wait till the last minute, you know, just because it's a task you're unfamiliar with.
Well, Connie, can you give us an inventory, whether we're that, you know, the spouse who doesn't do the finances, or just, you know, an individual or maybe a kid emerging into adulthood? What are a few basics that we should try to get under our belt, get a grasp on?
Well, for one thing, especially when it comes to taxes, drop the notion that the typeface that the IRS uses is somehow going to electrify you if you look at it too long. There is such an amount of terror around the notion of managing your own taxes. I recently had the pleasure, and I will actually call it that in public, of doing my disabled daughter's tax return. I had not usually done that before. And I actually found it, I know I'm a little weird about this, I actually found it strangely pleasurable, because each line has instructions. The instructions fit. the schedules that support the information fit exactly where they're supposed to be. It's almost like they're actually sort of beautifully designed. I know that's a strange minority opinion.
What's a lovely way to think about it, though, to overcome the terror,
but
I guess.
It's a strange sort of puzzle mm-hmm. that you're putting together, and there's a logic to it that unfolds itself as you work on it that I found strangely satisfying.
But you're a money person, though. See, I am not, and I think I would find it more terrifying. So for the emotional side of it, for someone who's not like you are, swimming mm-hmm. in the sea of financial literacy every day, what can we do to get over some of those emotional hurdles?
Well, you still have to face the fact that you are a taxpayer and you have to organize information. So if you're doing it for yourself for the first time, you probably are going to want to hire somebody. But I'm still going to say that the tax organizer that somebody should send in advance, which is a long questionnaire of the things that you ought to be thinking about, answering, gathering, documentation that you should bring in, that makes a lot of sense. Of course, there are also programs that you can use, and those are pretty popular. There's a movement that's been lobbied for that the federal government actually has, by the time tax time rolls around, almost all the information it needs to pretty much pre-fill in your tax return for you. But the outfits that do this for a living, including the tax program companies that sell the software, really don't want that to happen. So this could be an easier task if we didn't see that there was certain financial interests involved in just the preparation.
So embrace the taxes, get rid of the terror. What's another good step in just getting a mental handle, an emotional handle on our getting and spending?
Well, certainly getting to know yourself and getting to know something about the way that you find things full of feeling. I'm often struck by the fact that we mistake the feelings about facts for the facts themselves. So when we feel fearful about taxes, it might be that there's a whole coaching or history to, I'm supposed to be afraid of this, this is scary, this is beyond me. There's got to be a whole script that's running through somebody's mind that says, I'm not adequate to this, even when you are perfectly adequate in other ways. So again, focusing on the tax situation, it's a nice little sort of opening into the larger world of financial personality, where the notion that it's a task with pieces, the pieces are doable, evokes this large sort of kind of tornado of emotional feelings that can actually paralyze you from actually taking steps, one step at a time, just pecking at it.
We're talking about money, relationships, and emotions with Connie Kilmark, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234.
What's the division of labor in your family when it comes to finances? Does one spouse have all the information, one partner just hoping for the best? Well, who's in charge of getting the taxes done, paying the bills, tracking retirement accounts? And how do you share knowledge and responsibility? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation with financial counselor Connie Kilmark, looking at our emotional relationship with money and how financial issues work in our relationships.
And you can join the conversation. How do you divide the financial labor in your marriage? If you're a parent, have you worked with your kid of whatever age on understanding these money issues? Or are you dealing with finances for an aging parent? Call and share your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And Connie, what do you do when you think, or maybe your partner thinks that you're the one who needs to get up to speed, but you're not getting it, you're not tracking, and you're not where either of you want you to be? What's the next best step to stop things from spiraling?
Well, the person who seems to know the most about money may be a person who has an especially analytical sort of Excel spreadsheet kind of brain. And that person will repeatedly explain the information that he or she wants you to know in the same exact way, in the way that makes the most sense to him or her. And that often is the impediment. It isn't necessarily the information. It's the way it's displayed and the way it's arrayed. And that actually can be quite a hurdle. So I would suggest that if there's been conflict or even and I would hope that this is not the case, contempt that's been developing for the person who seems not to have a knack for gathering or understanding this kind of information, that that person not receive instruction from the conflicted spouse or the conflicted partner, because it can be made nerve-wracking. Learning chess or learning bridge from somebody who yells at you or calls you foolish for making a particular bidding mistake will spoil the entire game. So I would say get a second person from the outside who is where the stakes are much lower, and begin to get yourself up to speed so that when you do enter the conversation with the more knowledgeable partner, you have gained some expertise before you start that conversation.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Amy on the line in Milwaukee. Amy, hi.
Hi. Something that my partner and I have found to be very helpful is that we set up a monthly calendar date on our shared Google calendar, and it's just a dedicated Starbucks and budget discussion. And not just about budget, but about any questions that we might have for each other. In this relationship, he happens to be the person that is more aware of what everything is going on behind the scenes, and that's new for me. Typically, I had been, taking care of myself, and in my former relationship, taking care of the money. So for me to know that time is coming up on the calendar, and it's an opportunity to have maybe random questions that have gone through my mind about money or something that I just don't understand, is really helpful. And it also, I think, stops us from having those really quick conversations where we don't get enough information from one another. And we know that this is dedicated time for us to both get on the same page about what's going on.
Amy, thanks a lot for the call. What I like about that idea is it's not, we have a crisis, we need to talk, but it's a regular gig no matter what's going on.
Well, I think that's crucially important, that you make it ordinary and routine. When you only talk about money when you absolutely have to, and then you're unsuccessful, you postpone talking about it the next time even longer because it was painful or it was prickly. And then when you do, there's even more urgency behind it, and it becomes unsuccessful again. And so you've developed a vortex of unsuccessful interactions. So what our caller has suggested is make it ordinary, make it routine. Sometimes perhaps nothing but a good cup of coffee is involved in such a nice meeting, and maybe nothing of great import comes up. But I love the idea of something routine and ordinary.
Thank you for that call. And Angela in Green Bay sent us an email. She said, I'm in a newish relationship, but we're at different income levels. How do we bridge the gap when it comes to going out and doing things? I feel bad that I can't afford all the things he wants to do, but it also makes me uncomfortable when he pays for too much.
Well, it's a classic challenge to couples when there's a difference in income, and these days it can happen in either direction in a heterosexual couple, and it's always a power differential when there's a differential of income, significant differential of income. In many cases, people will have an hour account, which is where each of you puts proportional amounts of money into the things that will benefit each of you similarly, housing, electricity, water bill, those kinds of things. And then have a my account that will allow you each to have some dignity and some autonomy where you're not accounting to each other for those amounts. The person with the more can always invite the other to do something that he will then offer to treat. The person who has somewhat less may choose to offer to suggest something, but then the items would be split 50-50. It's actually rather important that hour account be split proportionally and not 50-50, because otherwise you really do end up with second-class citizenship in the relationship.
Talking to Connie Kilmark about our money, emotions, getting a handle on our relationship with money. Connie, I had mentioned earlier kids and trying to instill these lessons, this interest, this attention to finances. What recommendations would you have?
Well, know thyself first, because you can't teach what you don't know. We often will try to do on our kids what was done on us, and so we'll attach allowances to chores, or we'll say if you don't earn it, you can't have it. We don't do that with food. As adults, we don't eat unless we work, but as children, we would hope that we're not being told that if you don't do your chores, you can't eat at the table. So I would suggest that money be a lesson that we teach our children by experience. That is to say, we offer them some power, age-appropriate amount of actual spending money, that the money be for a time period that is manageable and understandable to the child, so perhaps a week at a time for a young child. What you're really trying to do is teach gratification and the fact that once some money is spent, it's not going to come back to you. You're trying to teach this to people before they become vulnerable to credit card offers so that they know by the time they can sign a credit card offer that there isn't a free lunch out there waiting for them. So a longer and longer period of time and a little bit more autonomy over time for the child. Also, parents ought not to rub their noses in it when the child makes a mistake and say, I told you so. None of us like to be told, I told you so, ever. Let the actual natural consequences of the choice be the teacher and ask the child, how did that feel when you didn't have money to go wherever you wanted to go on Saturday? Children can do a pretty good job of self-evaluating if they're doing it in a safe environment where their responses are okay to have.
Connie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
That's Connie Kilmark, financial counselor, founder of counseling and consulting firm Kilmark Associates, giving us some lessons to help us kick off a federal Money Smart Week.
And you can drop by the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us how you work on the money in your family, with your partner, with your children. Do you have any advice for helping people have healthy relationships, both with money and with each other? Let us know what you think over on the Central Time Facebook page.
There's a new class of inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's as of Saturday night.
The woman known as the godmother of punk, Joan Jett, was inducted among those inducted. If you were a teenager in the 80s, you remember her hits Crimson and Clover, I Love Rock and Roll. Sounds like she was choked up at the standing ovation a lot of fans gave her, and remarkably unfazed by the kind of inappropriate remarks made by her, made about her by fellow singer Miley Cyrus.
It's Miley Cyrus. I guess we'd be surprised if she didn't say something a little off kilter anyway. Also getting the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame green light on Saturday, Ringo Starr and Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble. A singer John Mayer introduced Vaughan, called him the ultimate guitar hero.
Well, congrats to everybody in that latest class to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It may be an old song, but I really still love this song.
Home, where we can